Okay, I'll get started. Hello. Okay, it's an honor to be here. I had the incredible privilege of having my office down the hall from Rabbi Dr. Feuerman for a long time, for a very long time. I think it must have been a long time. I don't remember exactly how long, but it was, at least 15 years or so, which meant I had constant interaction. And I want to share. Okay, so do I have the mic on? Okay. I'll bring it higher. Got it. You hear me now, everybody? Is that better? Is that too high? Okay. Let me talk about four lessons I learned from the incredible privilege of being able to really get to know and learn from Rabbi Dr. Feuerman. The first has to do with focus. He had a gift for really being there. He really gave you his undivided attention. But then, afterwards, invariably, he'd write a little note where there'd be a little verbal thank you with very, very specific praise. He practiced what he preached. Very specific praise. He'd say, here's what I liked about what you said in this faculty meeting. Here's what I appreciated in our interaction in the hall. I once was very, very pressured for time. And he wanted to meet with me about something. And I told him, you know something, I have 5 minutes in between this commitment and that commitment. He said, well, you know, I don't know if that's enough. I said, 5 minutes? You could accomplish a world in 5 minutes. He went off on that. He wrote me a note. He made it the basis of a Dvar Torah in a talk that he gave. He made me feel terrific, even though I was, in a way, being disrespectful by not prioritizing. When I look back on it, whatever, I don't remember what it was that made me unable to be there with him. I should have been there with him. He understood the importance of deep connection, which is all too rare today. Let me share with you, I guess I'll just share one study. It's a study that many of you may have heard of, but it's what I think of when I think about this component of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman's SL. It's the Good Samaritan study. Anybody know about the Good Samaritan study? It's a great study. Princeton Theological Seminary. So the Princeton Theological Seminary, they had a major assignment that was part of the final grade that these divinity students would get. And it was in public speaking, a very important part of what they had to master in order to get their doctorates in divinity. And they were asked to prepare a speech on the Good Samaritan. Now, the Good Samaritan, I'll Judaize it, because that's almost certainly where it came from. I'm not a scholar in this area at all. I'm sure there are people in this room who are far more knowledgeable than I am about it. But it's basically the story of Ha'alama. That if you see, of Ha'alama, okay? The story of Ha'alama, which I'll explain. Okay? It's that if you see your neighbor struggling under a load, even if that neighbor is an enemy you don't particularly like, you can't pretend to not see them. Okay? You can't pretend to somehow have your focus elsewhere. You have to look at them. You have to see them. Okay? And the Torah tells us, Hakem tokem imo, okay? And literally, you have to stop whatever you're doing and go to their aid. It's a fundamental Jewish concept that then was adopted, you know, in the New Testament. But these men and women of the Princeton Theological Seminary were told, prepare a drusha on this story of Halama, and then we're going to test you on it. Okay? In another building on this sprawling campus. So listen to what happens in this classic study. The men and women who were preparing and about to get a bechina on their speaking skills are on their way to the other building to have this major test on their speaking skills. And on the way, halfway between one building and the next, there's two psychologists. They don't know they're psychologists. And one pretends to have a heart attack. And he goes, oh, help me, help me. And the other says, I don't know CPR. Somebody come and help me. And passing by are these seminary students who are about to give a drasha on how hakein take mimo. You have to have their back, okay? Don't pretend not to see. Go to their aid. Go save their lives. Many of them pretended not to see. And they went on, and waiting for them in the other building was another team of psychologists who asked them a simple question. You're about to give a speech on how you have to help somebody who's suffering, somebody who needs your help. No matter what, you have to be there. Okay? And why didn't you do it? And by far, the main predictor of whether or not they practiced what they preached or they became hypocrites who didn't live the lives that they were espousing was how much of a rush they were in. If they said they felt rushed, or they felt pressured, or they even felt anxious about this test, it blinded their empathy. It blinded their ability to literally do what the whole focus was about. Rabbi Dr. Feuerman was the lesson in focus, the lesson in living his life with a presence and a concentration on the needs of others. I never saw him in a rush. Never. I don't know how he did it. And I wish I learned more from him, because I'm always in a rush. I never saw him in a rush. He was always there. He was always very calmly, you know, wanting to talk to you, wanting to hear from you, wanting to basically be there at your side. And it was an amazing, amazing kind of lesson also in empathy. He believed in you. He believed in you. And he believed in everybody. He believed in every one of his talmidim, in every one of his students. And it was such a gift because that brings out the best in you. It brings out the best in you. So, you know, I'll share a study that I know almost everybody here heard from me before, but it's just so much what this component of Rabbi Dr. Feuerman's life was about. Now, the power of belief, the power of emuna in the other. So one is, first of all, the Rabbeinu Tzadok, right? Rabbeinu Tzadok says, "Kishem shetzarech adam lahamin b'Hashem yisparach." Just like we have to believe in God, so too Rabbeinu Tzadok of Lublin tells us we have to believe in ourselves. Ratzalomar sheyesh la kadosh baruch hu esek imo sheinenu poel batal shebein laila hoya uvein laila ova. We're not an insignificant being here one day and gone the next. And the study that I'll share with you is the monastery study. You guys have all heard the monastery study. If not, I'll share it with you. It looks like some of the, either you didn't hear it or you heard it and weren't paying attention, which is always my dream that I could repeat things for that reason. So here's the monastery study. It goes like this. Ellen Langer, prominent psychologist at Harvard University, one of the leading clinical psychologists of our time. So she takes over an abandoned monastery on the outskirts of Cambridge, near Harvard. And she takes eight men who are old, men in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s. And she has them spend 5 days in the monastery. But what they do to the monastery is they convert it to look like the world looked when these men were in their prime at age 40. Okay? They put in black and white televisions. They put in the kind of wallpaper that was in vogue at that time. All of the paintings on the wall. It was literally like time travel. It literally, they changed the monastery to look like when these men were many, many decades earlier. They then have these men come to the monastery. And they tell them, here's what we want you to do. Over the next 5 days, think of yourselves as being old, as being young, I'm sorry. Think of yourselves as being 40 years old. And not only that, treat each other like you're 40 years old. It's time travel. Treat each other like you're young. If they had a room on the fourth floor, they'd have to, no help with the suitcase. They'd have to carry all their clothing up, even if it meant one shirt at a time. Okay? Before they settled in. And for that 5 day period, they inhabited the psychological space of a young person, of a younger person. And then a week later, they had the comparison group, same number of men, treated like they were old. Treated like they were old. Then they come and they have independent raters rate the men, not knowing which group they were in. They show them pictures of them. And 100% of the time, the independent raters were able to say, oh, these people were in the young group. They look younger. 5 days later, they look younger. But here's where it gets almost, metaphysical. It gets hard to understand. They have a team of ophthalmologists come and give the men eye exams, not knowing which group they were in. And 100% of the time, the ophthalmologists find significantly improved vision in the men who thought of themselves as younger, nigh and tov. They somehow, their vision improved. There's a tremendous connection between vision and between emotions. I don't have the medical understanding to understand it, but I once did a study on trauma and abuse, a very large group of people around the country, and one of the things we found in abused people was an unusually high level of visual problems relative to controls. And we never quite understood, and I talked to colleagues who were ophthalmologists, we didn't quite understand it. When I saw the Langer study, it started to make at least a little bit more sense out of it. So the men showed greater flexibility. They just changed. Not forever, but for a while. This study's been replicated by BBC, who made a documentary about it. It's become a very famous study. But my favorite part of the study is that when the men were waiting outside of the monastery to go back to their homes in Cambridge, a reporter who was there covering the event, covering the study, reports, Dr. Langer never reported it, but in the newspapers it was reported, that they spontaneously started playing a game of two-hand touch football. Okay? These are men in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. They lived up to each other's expectations. Okay? Huh? I don't know. My guess is if you take a group of women and you believe in them also, it'll probably work even better. That would be my guess. But I can't imagine why it wouldn't work just as powerfully, if not more powerfully, with women. Why Dr. Langer chose men, I have no idea. I don't know. That part, she's still around. You can write her an email. Okay? So the take-home message here, in terms of finishing this first of the four points I want to talk about, is basically the Rabbi Dr. Feuerman, he believed in us. He believed in our students. He believed in me, personally. He made me better. He made me better. I always wanted to live up to that. You know it. I'm looking at his family members, because he always talked about you with such love and such belief and such pride and such expectation. It was like really amazing. You know, I'm sure there was another side to it at times, and maybe, no, there wasn't. It was real, pure. I love it. Okay, great. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two, we heard beautifully in the two previous speakers, and that's his unbelievable openness to the perspective of others. So as I've told our doctoral students here, you know, one of the challenges of our time is to learn how to live in the mist. The Torah was given in the Arafel, right? It says, Vashem Nigash al Harafel. Moshe accepted the Torah in the mist, in the fog. And that's a Jewish value, is to be comfortable with ambiguity, to be comfortable with the perspective of others, but to be more importantly, to be comfortable and open to the perspective of others. What an unbelievably inspiring man in that area. Here's a man who was he a colonel in the Air Force? What was he? He was a chaplain. He had some kind of, he had like a rank. Don't chaplains have a rank? Yeah. Yeah. So he was high up there. And sometimes you'd be talking to him and he'd talk about what he learned in his time serving in the Air Force. Sometimes, as I believe everybody knows, it's not a secret, he would not only quote the Pachad Yitzchak, quote Rav Huttner, his Rebbe, who shaped him, but it became clear that he wrote it. He was too modest to tell people, but, you know, I can't get in trouble with him now that I know of, okay? Right? He wrote it. He wrote many of the volumes of the Pachad Yitzchak were written by Rabbi Feuerman. Is that true? That's what he told me. And some of them were put in. There were sections that were written. There are times I heard even beyond that. Doesn't matter. What matters is that he was so close and he had so absorbed and so much became a Talmud Mufak of Rav Huttner that he literally carried him inside of himself and was able to integrate while at the same time quoting Heschel and quoting his rebbeim in the Air Force, and quoting some of his many other teachers who came from all walks of life, as we heard, Madeline Hunter and others. And he had this incredible gift to kind of be the antidote to the black and white thinking of today. He didn't go for that. He knows that we need to understand how to live in the mist, how to live in the fog. You know, as we've discussed, you know, our doctoral students, right? Every few blots in Shas, we have the word tiyufta. You're right. I'm wrong. You gave me an answer I can't even answer. Or kasha. That's a question I don't have the answer to. Or teiku. We'll know the answer when the Mashiach comes. That was what he taught me. He taught me how to live in the fog. He taught all of his students that we could live in the fog and we could learn how to live in the fog. Okay? So there's that component as well. Okay. So let me go to point number three. Okay? Is his Ayin Tov. pleasure in the success of others. Let me just tell you that I guess this comes from a deep confidence that he had in himself. He didn't need to prove anything. You know, there's a beautiful Rav Kook, and he taught me so many, he would often come to me and show me this Tiferes Yisrael, or this Rav Kook, or this, I mean, just sort of like he was a real Rebbe to me. He was like, so he, one of the things that I think epitomized the broad shoulders and the Ayin Tov, because he gave, there was no competition whatsoever. He just wanted everybody who he came into connection with to succeed. So he epitomized the Rav Kook that I just am always quoting this to myself, but it's very, very hard, but he lived it. Yesh ben chorin sherucho ruach shaleved. There are free people who have the spirit of a slave. V'yesh eved sherucho malei cheros. And there are slaves who have a spirit filled with freedom. Hanemon la'atzmiyuso ben chorinhu. Somebody who's faithful to their inner essence will always be free. Umi shekolchayov rak b'mashetovi yafe be'enei acherim. Somebody whose entire life is about what's good, okay? What other people want, impression management, who have it. They're always going to be a slave. He lived a life filled with freedom. Not in a way that was in the least bit obnoxious. Not in a way that was in the least bit judgmental, but in a way that just came from a deep connection and confidence in himself. And because of that, he was able to give without narrow shoulders. He was able to give without sensitivity. When I was working on some books with my father, Zal, he knew that I was working on it, and he asked to see the galleys. He asked to see it before it actually got published. And then, maybe, I don't know, a week later, he never procrastinated. Maybe a week later, I got margin notes on every single page, multiple notes and multiple citations and multiple kinds of brilliant insights that I still have to make time to integrate. You know, he very much wanted his children to have similar projects with him. Okay? He that was his dream, and it's not too late. It's definitely not too late. I've always been amazed at what does it take to have both, first of all, that kind of confidence, that kind of certainty, and that time of lack of competitiveness. You know, it was like really, it was really truly inspiring how he helped. And Ayin Tov, he was able to take pleasure in the success of others and able to somehow convey that in a really deep and specific kind of way. And now the final point, and this I'll maybe spend a little bit more time on. And this has to do with the gift of connection. The gift of connection. You know, there's more and more research on connection and the power of connection. As we know now, what country, I think, was it? England now has a minister of loneliness. Is that the UK or is it some other country? Minister of loneliness. They've realized that loneliness is such a danger to our health. It's such a danger to our immune system. And that lonely people die on average much earlier than people who are connected. Okay? And that doesn't mean having a lot of friends. It means a deep connection, being able to be present with people, to be able to connect to them and see them eye to eye, face to face, kamayim alpanim alpanim, with our hearts bouncing off each other. And in an age of loneliness, he was a master of connection. There's new research on something called blue zones. You know what blue zones are? They do studies around the world, and they ask a simple question. Where, in what parts of the world, do people live the longest? Where do people live the longest? Huh? B'nai B'rak is a complicated literature. Right. The Israel, that's a talk in itself. But where people live the longest, and this is different parts of the world, probably, what's that? Parts of Greece and the Greek islands, yeah, but it always shifts. Every year it shifts. Israel's been up there, totally counterintuitively, because there's a strong sense of meaning, purpose, and connection. But one of the main predictors of a blue zone is the level of connection. It's how many friends, real friends you have. Not Facebook friends, which is associated with the opposite, but real connected friends, okay? And it's fascinating that that's what comes up, and that's the main ingredient of resilience, okay? It's the gift of connection. I wanted to share with you a fascinating book that came out relatively recently. It's called Happiness is a Choice You Make. And listen to what this book found. It was a very simple book. It was a person named Leland, happens to be a New York Times reporter, went and he hung out with, for a whole year, 6 very old people in New York City. Really old people. To try to, in a deep way, learn the lessons they learned in their lives. You know, what's the deep lessons learned? And he said, and a lot of people who read this book say this book changes their lives. It changes your life. And it's the lessons that we know Rabbi Dr. Feuerman used to guide his life. Okay? It's the way he lived. He was in chronic pain. He was in pretty chronic pain. Because of a terrible accident that took place, I don't know how many years before I even came to know him, because of an automobile I don't know, how do you refer to it? An accident or whatever, it was an accident. But he was in, I think, my guess is he was in pain every, constantly. And yet, he lived his life in a way that he was able to overcome that chronic challenge in a way that was unbelievably inspiring. You know, here's what Leland found from the old people he worked with. He found that their philosophy in life is don't worry about what might happen. Okay? Okay? And then when it happens, you don't have to worry then, just deal with it, okay? And it's not a bad way to live your life. You know, worrying is a real waste. It's a real waste, unless it helps you plan for something. And he didn't, I never heard a complaint. I never heard a complaint. He knew how to give, he knew how to be tough on students who didn't do their work. He knew how to be, you know, on how to ask for a certain level of performance, but he did it in such a gentle way, and in such a way that was reflecting this philosophy, you know, Leland's philosophy. You know, there's a saying which really epitomized his life, which is, teachers teach themselves. Doesn't mean they teach themselves. It means teachers, what you teach when you're a teacher is you teach yourselves. Your students pick up who you are. What was the name of his aide again? Huh? Spell it. What? Noel, right. How could I have forgotten? He had an aide. His name was Noel, who drove him everywhere, helped take care of him. It was, I think he was from one of the islands, from the Caribbean. He was he's from Jamaica, right. And remarkably devoted, gentle man. I don't know the Rabbi Dr. Feuerman ever sat down with him and ever taught him Pirkei Avos, or ever formally taught him. But you saw how teachers teach themselves all the way through. He hung out a lot. He came to my family simchas, loved shalt, by the way. And most amazingly, at the funeral, at the cemetery, Noel was crying uncontrollably. And then he gave a hesped. He gave a eulogy at the graveside. He just started to talk. And it was one of the most, do you remember? I don't know if you have it on tape. It was amazing. It was amazing. And it was eloquent. And it captured the lessons learned from a great man. The lessons learned from the teacher whose essence taught him what he needed to know about life. Because he didn't have that in his own life. So he had this father. And he responded with that kind of intensity. And that's an unbelievable kind of legacy. And I'll end with one final thought. One final thought. So all this recent research on emotions and how emotions are taught. A lot of work on the neurobiology of emotions, Dr. Damasio. We're beginning to understand a little bit more about the power of all of that. And the power of how you teach values. And the bottom line is that the way values are taught, it's by what parents and teachers focus on. What's important to you? What do you focus on? And what do you get emotional about? Those ingredients are what lead to internalization of values. And I'll end with a story. Even though I have about 2-3 stories flipping around in my head. Let me end with a story about Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was one of the major poskim and leaders of the last generation. And I heard this story from one of his students who was there when it happened, a South African rabbi. I heard it from a few other sources. And everybody says this story the same way, and they say that it's what shaped them and made them who they are today. So I'll tell over the version that I heard from from the South African rabbi, because it sticks with me, because he said, this is what shaped who I am today. And it was just one event. And it epitomizes what do people spend time on, what do they get emotional about. So one day, students come to...
Okay,
you got it, thanks a lot.
You're tethered.
Thanks. One day, students come to Kol Torah, to the yeshiva where Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was the Rosh Yeshiva. And the word gets out from the Mashkiach of the yeshiva that morning Seder is canceled. Unheard of. It never happened before in the history of the yeshiva, except maybe when there was a terror attack. But morning Seder was canceled because Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, wanted to give a talk to the boys. And people were really shaken. That never happened. What's this all about? You're canceling learning Torah? What trumps Torah? Nothing. It just doesn't happen in that place. And he gets up, and he's in tears. He's in tears. It's the emotion part. And he says, through his tears, as he breaks down, he says, let me tell you why I canceled morning Seder. He said, let me tell you what happened yesterday in my neighborhood. He says, you all know my neighborhood. I built the Eruv there, right? Whether you hold from it or you don't hold from it, it's my neighborhood. And There was an ufruf in shul yesterday, in the shul that I daven in, Shabbat Chatan. And I see the chassan in this very hot, really, really, brutally, oppressively hot day. I see his father is carrying three folding chairs on one hand, three folding chairs on the other hand, and he's sweating profusely, and he's walking to the shul where the kiddush is going to be after davening, where the ufruf is going to be and kriyas tahara is going to be, and his father's walking by him, and father's setting up the chairs. Then father goes back home with the chassan following him, and again, same thing, six chairs, all carried by the father. Shlomo Zalman says, so I watched this for a couple of iterations of the back and forth, and I just couldn't control myself anymore. And I turn to the chassan, and I scream, keep it off, keep it off, what's wrong? Keep it off. And then he breaks down crying again. Can't control himself, Shlomo Zalman. And he says, you know what he answered me? He answered me with pride. I don't hold from the Seraph. And then he breaks down even more. And he says, where have we failed you? Where have we failed you? You know? Forget whatever you hold in Hilchos Eruvin. Forget all of the many reasons why he wasn't understanding the basics of Hilchos Eruvin. Okay? But more important, this is the Raisa. This is the Doraisa. It's the Raisa of Kibbutz. Where have we failed you that you're focusing on the wrong thing? Where have we failed? And he breaks down crying again. So, what this Rav told me, he said, I was changed from that day on. I was changed by the tears. I was changed by the lesson. I was changed by the entire experience. You know, Revolbi wrote a beautiful essay in Alei Shur called Al HaFrumkeit, on how Frumkeit could be an instinct that runs wild. That runs wild. And I spoke about Al HaFrumkeit a number of times with Rabbi Dr. Feuerman Zatzal, because this drove him crazy. It drove him crazy. Because he lived a life of imparting that lesson to others. He lived a life of teaching by modeling. And he lived a life that gave such a consistent message in terms of what he cared about, what he spent time on, and what got him emotional. It was never done with tears. It was never done that I knew of, okay? It was always done just with sincerity and being an ultimate model. So thank you for allowing me to talk. I've had this stuck inside of me for a while, and Yehei Zichro Baruch. It's an inspiration for all of us. Thank you.